Okay, so y'all ready to get started? So here we are in chapter 20. This is the last chapter. This is the first lecture. Chapter 20 is on international finance. So let's start with the first slide. And what determines the exchange rates of different currencies? Well, first of all, what gives any country's currency value on the international market? What gives any currency value? I mean, if currencies are not backed up by gold or silver, which they are not, since we're not on the gold standard, what gives value to a country's currency? Well, I can rephrase that question. I say, what gives value to that door over there? What gives value to this computer monitor? Usefulness and
scarcity.
Very good. Those two things give anything value. How useful is it, and how scarce it? The more useful, the more scarce, the greater the value in the market. Now, what gives a currency value? It's useful, and it's relatively scarce. The fact that you can take American dollars and buy American goods and services makes dollars useful. And now it helps that on the dollar it says this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means that if you owe someone $100 and you give them a $100 bill, they have to accept that $100 bill as payment of debt because the laws of this land recognize Fed Reserve notes as payment of debt. Right? Now, of course, money is in many forms, and what is money? Well, it need not even be paper. What is it?
Oh,
it's simply, it doesn't even have to be anything material. It doesn't have to be anything physical. Money is anything that can be used to signify someone's debit and someone's credit in a financial transaction. See, when if I give you a $20 bill, what does that $20 bill represent? Well, it represents you're better off by $20 and I'm poor by $20, right? Well, anything that does that is money. If I write you a check and you cash that check, your account is credited by $20, mine is debited by $20, right? See, so checks are money. Or it could be simply an electronic transfer, debits and credits. That's all money is. Now, that's all money is because we're not on the gold standard. Now, what determines the value of the exact value of a country's currency? Now, what we've been talking about is what gives money value, right? But what determines the exact value? In other words, why is a dollar worth what it is relative to, let's say, the euro? Now, what gives major countries' currencies, what determines their value on the international market? Now, I've asked that question so often in different ways. What gives a currency value on the international market? The answer is always the market. What gives value in the market? The market. And what is the market? A market is always demand and supply. Correct? Now, if we're talking about the value of currencies on the international market, then we're talking about the demand and supply of a country's currency on the international market. See, why do people demand American dollars, for example? Because why do you want money? Because you can do things with that money, right? You can buy things, right? Well, why do foreigners want American dollars? For the same reason. With American dollars, they can buy American goods and services. With American dollars, they can buy American real estate. They can put money in the American stock market. They can see what I mean? I mean, that's as long as we have things that people want, and the only way to get those things is to have American dollars, then there will be a demand for the dollar on the international market. Same with the euro. I mean, why do people demand euros? Well, because those countries in Europe sell goods and services, and you need euros to buy those goods and services. So what determines the exact value of the dollar relative to the value of the euro? Well, demand and supply. If the demand for the dollar increases relative to the supply, what happens to the value? Value goes up. Or it may be a case of supply. What happens when the supply of dollars increases on the international market? What happens to the value, everything else being equal? Goes down. So it's both demand and supply. Okay? So I'm still on slide one. What determines the exchange rates of different currencies? The supply and demand of that currency on the international market. What determines the demand for a currency on the international market? Foreigners demand another country's currency for what that currency can buy in that country. So you show me a country that doesn't have anything that people want, then I'll show you countries whose currency is worthless on the international market. I mean, why would anyone want to possess some country's currency if it wouldn't be of any value to you? And if you don't want to possess it, if people don't want to possess it, then there's not going to be a demand for it. Therefore, it will have zero value on the international market. Okay, what determines supply for currency on the international market? When citizens of a country buy goods and services from another country. See, when we buy from other countries, what's happening? Well, they give us goods, we give them dollars, so what's happened to the supply of dollars on the international market? Goes up. Now, what other ways can dollars leave our country other than buying goods and services? Debt could be, in today's world, that if you're talking about the United States, that's probably a biggie right there. If we owe someone money and you know, debt wise, and when we pay them, that's money out, and a good portion of our national debt is owned by foreigners, right? And that's a good sum. What is our national debt right now? How many trillion? About
1.6.
No, a little higher.
About 15.
No, it's about 11 trillion. Our foreign debt right now is about 11 trillion, a little over 11 trillion. But what's it expected to be by the end of 2009?
12, 14.
14. Expected to increase about 2 trillion in 1 year. Now, let's say that the government is paying out, on the average of maybe 5% or 6% interest on that debt. Now, yeah, right. I mean, this is something that we got to pay on every year, every quarter, literally every day. So, how much interest? How much money are you talking about here? Well, you're talking about a good sum of money. You're talking about as much as 17% of our total budget just goes to pay the interest on the national debt. And how much of that national debt is owned by foreigners? I don't think it's that high, and I'd only be guessing, but it's. It's somewhere like 40% or so. That's a rough guess, actually, but I think it's about 40% of what we owe is owed to foreigners. But that's increasing. The amount of money we owe to foreigners is increasing. But the point I'm making here, now, I'm not really getting off track because a part of the reason for this chapter is a review of the basic concepts. So what we're doing here is we're using these concepts and knowledge that we've learned before, but applying these concepts and knowledge to the international picture rather than the national picture. That's what this chapter is really all about. That's why I like doing this chapter last, because it's a good review chapter for the basic concepts. Okay, what are flexible exchange rates? Rates are determined by the forces of demand and supply without government intervention. Now, we have what is called a relatively flexible international exchange rate system. In other words, the values of major currencies are determined by market forces, essentially. Now, that's not absolutely true, but ultimately, the value of a country's major country's currency is determined by the forces of demand and supply. Now, many minor countries peg their currency to a major currency. Now, one of those minor currencies aren't so minor anymore, and that's China. China still pegs its currency to the dollar. But that's got to change, because China is such a major player now on the international market. But major currencies like the euro and the dollar are determined by market forces, demand and supply. And that's what we call a freely flexible international exchange rate system. Because, see, it wasn't always like this. Now, we're going to look at some of the history here of exchange rates, and you're going to see that at times we have used a different system than a freely flexible system. And you're also going to learn that our system is basically freely flexible, but not absolutely. Because there's a term here that we're going to learn, and the term is float. 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 What we're saying here is that a freely flexible international exchange rate system is a system that allows certain countries or countries' currencies to float. To float means that they're going to be determined by market forces. But there's also another term, and that term is a dirty float. What is a dirty float? A dirty float is, well, we're going to let a country's currency be determined by market forces, but we're going to be able to influence those market forces. In other words, we're going to be able to influence either demand and supply, and therefore influence the value of that country's currency. Now, notice here I'm using the word influence and not the word control. Under a freely flexible international exchange rate system, we certainly, no government can control the value of its currency. But with our system, and you're going to learn how, but there are ways that we can influence, we can nudge it up or nudge the value down. And why we would do that is also a topic of this chapter. So here we have a picture of a market, right? Downsloping demand curve. That should be quite familiar to you now. Demand curves are downward sloping because as the price goes down, the quantity demanded goes up, right? People want to buy more, and price goes up, people want to buy less. And the supply curves are upward sloping because as the price increases, now, somebody, why are supply curves upward sloping? Why is it that as the price goes up, the quantity supplied goes up, and as the price goes down, the quantity supplied goes down?
People buy more, make more.
Make more. Why?
They have jobs.
Make more money.
Make more money. Money incentive. As a price, if you're the supply, now keep in mind you got to keep these two separate, right? There's a demand and there's a supply. Demand curve represents those who are doing the demanding. Supply represents those who are doing the supplying. So if you're just looking at the suppliers, as the price goes up for this good or service, why do we know that the supplier can make more money? Yes, that's the answer, exactly. because we always assume that everything else stays the same. When we change price, we always assume that nothing else changes. Therefore, if you're the supplier and the price goes up and nothing else changes, meaning, for example, your costs don't change, then you can make more money. And because we live in a free enterprise system where the incentive is profit, correct? And it's not only to make a profit, but business owners want to maximize their profit. So as the price goes up for something, then there's going to be more incentive for people, for investors and business people to supply more. As the price goes down, less incentive, so the quantity supply goes down. So far, this is just basic review, right? And so here we have the downslope and demand curve, upper slope and supply curve, and where they intersect is where the equilibrium price is at. Why is this intersection an equilibrium? First of all, what does that term equilibrium mean? Come on now, this ought to be old hat to you by now. Well, you can explain it in one word. One word. What does equilibrium mean?
Average, static, balance.
No. Tendency. That's the word. Tendency. The word it's looking for is tendency. An equilibrium is the point toward which the economy tends. See, how do we prove that this price here, where the quantity demand equals quantity supplied, is an equilibrium? How do you prove that any point is an equilibrium if it indeed is an equilibrium? If the equilibrium means a tendency toward, how do you prove that a point is an equilibrium? In other words, you move away from it and then see what happens. Right? If you move away from it and there's a natural tendency to move back toward that point, then what is that point? An equilibrium. That's what equilibrium means. It means that if you're not there, there's a tendency to move back toward that point. So if you're looking at the demand supply, what we're looking at here is the demand supply for a country's currency on the international market. How do we prove that where the quantity demanded equals the quantity supplied is an equilibrium price? Well, what do?
Move away.
In this case, you can go either up or down, right? If you go up, as the price goes up, what happens to what do demanders say to themselves?
Demanders.
We want less. Demanders want to buy less, but what do suppliers say to themselves?
Make more.
We want to make more, so eventually what do we have? A surplus. And with a surplus, how do we get rid of the surplus? Lower the price. And if you go below where quantity matters, quantity supplied. See, as the price goes down, what do suppliers say to themselves? Hey, we don't want to supply as much, but what do demanders say to themselves?
We want to buy more.
And so you get a shortage. And in a free market, when there's a shortage, how do we decide who gets and who doesn't get?
Money and want,
right? It takes both. It's like a bidding process goes on, and the highest bidder bidders get and other people don't get. So, you know, we now have decided who gets and who doesn't get according to the market. So this is the way international currencies work. This is ultimately what determines at least major countries' currencies' value on the international market. Okay. Now, here, what this shows us is what happens when there's an increase in demand for a country's currency. Well, what happens to the value? Value here being price. on the vertical axis. Goes up. And what happens to the quantity, the equilibrium quantity? It goes up, right? Or this can happen, right? There can be a decrease in demand for countries' currencies, or currency. So as the demand goes down from D to D prime, what happens to the market value or the international exchange rate? It goes down, as does the quantity on the international market. Of course, this can happen too, right? What happens when there's an increase in supply of, let's say, let's talk about the dollar. What happens when there's an increase in supply of the dollar in the international market? Well, with an increase in supply, or actually this is a decrease in supply. The next one is an increase, but if a decrease in supply, what happens to the market price or the value of that country's currency? It goes up. And, of course, the other way would be an increase in supply. And then the value of that country's currency would go down. So both, either demand and or supply can change, which... See, what's one thing that we always know is going to happen? The only thing we know for sure is that things are going to change. Change is inevitable. So in the real world, these demand curves and supply curves are changing in accordance to market forces. And as they change, the value of these countries' currencies change. Now, how do interest rates affect the demand for currencies? See, going back to 1932, we've talked about this several times. Remember I talked about what really caused the Great Depression of the 1930s? Now, it was the buildup of excessive inventories by the end of the 20s due to investors' greed, right? Businessmen's greed, trying to keep prices high while producers low, while producing more, right? If we keep prices high and wages low and at the same time produce more, what has to result? No, excessive inventories. A surplus. Excessive inventories. And what causes any unemployment? Anytime, anywhere, what causes unemployment? Excessive inventories. Why, at what point will a business say, we're going to have to cut back production when they have excessive inventories? See, why is there some sign today of in certain pockets of our very depressed economy, why is there some signs of recovery? Because in some cases, first of all, there was growing unemployment because of excessive inventories, but if a business doesn't produce anymore but still sells, maybe not at the rate that they were selling before, but they're still selling product, right? Eventually, what's going to happen? Yeah, and so they're going to run out of product, so what are they going to have to do? Yeah, they're going to have to produce more. And when they produce more, they're going to have to hire more labor, and that's what we're experiencing in some cases today. Some of our sectors are experiencing that. Now, this brings us to this slide 11. How do interest rates affect the demand for currencies? Well, what's getting at here is in 1932, we decreased the money supply. And the purpose of decreasing the money supply... Now, with a decrease in money supply, what happened to our unemployment problem? Well, if the problem was insufficient demand and you decrease the money supply, what's going to happen? Demand's going to go down even more, which is going to bring about more unemployment, right? Well, why did we decrease the money supply in 1932? Come on now, why did we decrease the money supply in 1932? See, what's this slide all about here? How do interest rates affect the demand for currencies? Why did we decrease the money supply in 1932? Because if the supply of money goes down, what happens to the price of that money? Or now, what's the price of borrowed money? Interest, correct? So if we restrict the supply of money, what happens to interest rates?
Go up.
Go up. Now, why do we want to raise interest rates in 1932? Because we were concerned that too much of our money, our dollars, was leaving the country. See, foreigners were looking at the United States and they were saying, man, those guys are in big trouble, and I'm kind of afraid to keep my money there. I might lose it all, so I'm going to take my money out while I can. Well, how do we convince foreigners to keep their money here? We raise interest rates. I mean, see, one incentive for people to keep their money here is to earn interest in that money. So if we raise interest rates, we're encouraging more people to keep their money here. See, that's the tie-in here with interest rates. See, the slide 7 says, how do interest rates affect the demand for currencies? And the answer is, if interest rates fall in a country, the demand for that currency will fall and will depreciate, and vice versa. If interest rates go up, what's going to happen? Let's say interest rates go up in America relative to other countries, and everything else being equal, what's going to happen to the demand for the dollar on the international market? It's going to go up. See, more people say, hey, I want dollars to put into America to take advantage of these higher interest rates. And if interest rates goes down, see, let's say you were a foreigner and you owned several hundred million dollars. It may be your own money, or maybe you control some mutual fund or something. Now, what things would you look at? Okay, here, let's say you've got $100 million. And you're saying to yourself, I can keep this money anywhere in the world I want. Now, what kinds of things would you look at to determine where you're going to put your money? All right. One is interest, the return you can make in your money. But what are some other things? How healthy their market is. You don't want to put your money in a country who's on the verge of an economic collapse. Right? What else would you look for? Well, yeah, that's true. You want to put your money in a country that's growing. But now what happens if you put your money in a country and you say, oh, I can earn 10% return on this money, but in that same time period, inflation in that country is 10%. So let's say you buy a bond and your bond matures. And so when you get your money back, you're getting back 10% more in terms of the currency. But if prices are 10% higher, then you're buying. In other words, you're right back where you started. You haven't gained anything. So your real gain, A gain is the difference between the interest rate that you can receive and what inflation rate is of that country's currency. So you don't want to put your money in a country who has high rates of inflation. I mean, you could put your money in a country and earn 25% interest or even 50% interest, but if inflation over that same time period is 70%, then you could actually lose in real terms. All right? So the point I'm making here, however, is that when interest rates go up, relative. See, now when we're talking about international currencies, it's always relative to. You always have to say, well, this is happening relative to other currencies, or maybe relative to another currency like the euro. So if interest rates goes up relative to everything else, This is what we did in 1932. We decreased the money supply. That, in turn, increased interest rates. And the thinking was that these increase in interest rates will attract more foreigners, that more foreigners will say to themselves, well, there's more risk involved here, but because of these higher interest rates, I'm willing to take the higher risk, and I'll leave my money in America. Okay, so what is a country's exchange rate? The price of one country's currency measured in terms of another country's currency. That's the exchange rate. The international market determines the value of the dollar. The international market determines the value of the euro. So if you know the value of the dollar and you know the value of the euro, then you know what the dollar is worth relative to the euro and vice versa. That's what we call an exchange rate. Now, what determines different exchange rates? Relative price levels, interest, growth, and economic stability. These are the things we just talked about, right? These are the things that would determine or you would consider if you want to put your money in this country or that country. And the demand and supply, therefore, affects value on the international market. What does it mean when a currency is depreciated? An increase in the number of units of a particular currency needed to purchase one unit of a foreign exchange. To depreciate means it's worth less. If the American dollar depreciates relative to the euro, that means it's going to take more dollars in exchange for euros, because each dollar is worth less relative to the euro. And of course, the currency can appreciate too, right? Again, it's always relative to. If we say the dollar appreciates relative to the euro, that means that it becomes more valuable relative to the euro. Therefore, when we exchange dollars for euros, we're going to get back more euros than before. So currencies are always appreciating or depreciating on the world market. Now, what is a country's balance of payments? Summarizes all economic transactions that occur during a given time period between residents of that country and residents of other countries. Slide 16. Now, we've got two measures here. We've got the balance of trade and we've got the balance of payments. Now, when we buy from foreigners, we're buying goods from foreigners, money goes out, right? When we sell to foreigners, money comes in. Now, that's what's called the balance of trade. See, we're trading, and their money goes out, money comes in. But how can money go out and come in ways other than trade? Well, foreigners can travel here, that's money in. We travel there, that's money out. We buy foreign stock, that's money out. Foreigners buy American stock, that's money in. We buy foreign real estate, that's money out. Foreigners buy American real estate, that's money in. See, there's lots of ways that money can leave a country or enter a country. And the thing that we mentioned before, you mentioned, is the debt situation. When we pay interest on the debt to foreigners, that's money out. Now, this total flow of money is called the balance of payments. So the balance of trade is a part of the balance of payments. The balance of payments is the total amount of money leaving the country relative to the total amount of money entering the country. Now, if you're talking about the value of a country's currency, we're talking about the balance of payments, right? It's not just the balance of trade, but it's the balance of payments, because it's the total or of money out of the country or into the country that determines value of that country's currency, or at least it influences the value of that country's currency on the world market. So what is a balance on goods and services? The portion of a country's balance of payments account that measures the value of a country's exports of goods and services minus the value of its imports of goods and services. This is the balance on goods and services, which is what I was talking about in terms of balance of trade as opposed to balance of payments. Now, what is a net unilateral transfer? The unilateral transfer is gifts and grants received from abroad by residents of a country minus the unilateral transfers sent abroad. Gifts and grants is simply another way that money can leave a country or enter a country. So it's a part of the balance of payments, this unilateral transfer. What is a balance of current account? The portion of a country's balance of payments account that measures the country's balance on goods and services plus its net unilateral transfers. So this is simply a definition. You know, there are different ways of measuring these things, and this is simply a definition of the balance of current account. It's the balance of payments on goods and services plus its net unilateral transfers. So what is a capital account? The record of a country's international transactions involving purchases of sales of financial and real assets. So what your author is doing here is he's simply saying, look, you know, there's lots of different ways that money can leave and enter, and so we have these different categories. Okay, what is a payment surplus? When there's more money entering a country than there is leaving the country. We say that we have a payment surplus when more money enters than leaves. And of course, you can guess what the next slide is. Well, I guess not. What can payments? Why can payment surplus be a problem? Why would it be a problem if we've got more money coming in than going out? Now, especially if you're talking about a lot more money coming in and you're talking about it over a period of time. Why would that be a problem?
Trade's not balanced.
Well, what problem would we have in this country if a lot more money is coming in than going out? What problem would we have?
Okay.
See, what causes inflation?
Too much money
chasing too few goods, right? The inflation is when we increase the money supply more than we increase goods and services. So now, if we have a whole lot of money, I mean, you have to picture America as this sphere, and then out here is the rest of the world. Now, money from the rest of the world is coming into America in great numbers over a period of time. So what's happening to our money supply? It's going up. So if the money supply increases relative to goods and services, what could happen?
Inflation.
Now, and what is a payments deficit? Well, that would just be the opposite, right? When too much money is leaving, opposed to money coming in, then what problem might we have? And what problem might we have? Well, what are the two problems we're always concerned about? Inflation and unemployment. So if you've got, I mean, again, you know, here's America, here's the rest of the world. More money's leaving America like this, more and more. A lot of it over a long period of time. So we've got less and less money circulating. So what's going to happen? Well, with less money, people spend less. As they spend less, we experience more unemployment.
You know what's going on right now? And a lot of, you know, got a lot to do with what's happening right now?
Yeah. Well, the problem, yeah, of course we have more unemployment, but I'm not sure if the problem is that we're buying too much from foreign countries. I'm not sure if that's a real problem.
Haven't they been fussing, though, that we import so much and don't produce that much here?
Oh, yeah, that's a complaint in terms of we're dependent upon foreigners in terms of purchasing that, you know, we're not manufacturing as much as we used to, and so we're dependent upon foreign countries for, like, especially China, for things, you know, goods that we buy. But why does that happen? Why is it that in America we've got less emphasis on production than used to be the case? You know, we used to be an industrial country where we produced lots of goods, you know, manufactured goods, and then we sold these to foreign countries, and so we had lots of money coming in. But now, instead of manufacturing these goods ourselves, to a large extent, we're buying these from foreign countries. And what's one of the reasons why we've done this?
One reason is they can really go out cheaper, sell for a cheaper price.
Well, maybe, but remember also what we talked about in the last chapter. I mean, if you're an American company and you're paying, let's say, someone $20 an hour, and you can go to a foreign country and pay them $1 an hour, why might that $20 an hour be cheaper? No. No, I mean, everything else being equal. So if you've already set up shop, you can pay a foreigner to do the same thing now as an American worker, but you pay the foreign worker $1 an hour, you pay the American worker $20 an hour. Now, why might that $20 an hour be less expensive? Because I've only given you half the story. What's the other half of the story? No, it's inputs, outputs. See, it's not how much you pay someone alone, but as a result of paying them, how much you can get back. How productive are they? You know, if you pay that American worker $20 an hour and they make something in an hour that's got a value of $100, a market value of $100, then you pay them one-fifth of what they can produce. Now, you go to a foreign country and you pay them $1 an hour, but they can only produce something in an hour that has a value of let's say, $2, then you're paying them half of what they can produce. Now, which is a better deal? The American worker is a better deal. And why is the American worker very often more productive? Well, it's not necessarily because he works harder, although sometimes that's the case, but it's the system which he works within. It's our infrastructure. It's our superior road system, power system, communication system, and certainly it's a big part of it is all the machines we have, you see, that we're very highly capitalized. So that's not the reason. Why, you know, why is it that we have backed off from the production sector and left more of that to foreigners? The answer is that we have taken the caps off interest. We've taken the caps off what is called usury. Usury is unreasonable interest. That financial firms can, in the past 10 to 15 years, have been able to make huge returns on their financial investments. So let's say you're a business person and you've got, let's say, $20 million and you want to go into your own business. And you say, well, now let's see, I can go into the production business and make a 10% return on my investment, or I could go into the financial sector and make 100% return on my investment. Now, what are you going to do? You're going to say, well, why should I go in the production sector if I can go in the financial sector and make so much more? And that's why we're dependent upon China. Because our investors here in America have, our financial sector has greatly, our financial sector today is about 60% of our total GDP. See, that's a huge increase over the past 10 to 15 years. In fact, it's about doubled. And our manufacturing sector, by the same token, has decreased by that amount. And it's all dealing with, you know, what are the returns you can make in the financial sector as opposed to the returns you can make in the manufacturing sector if you're an investor. Well, things have certainly changed, but I was talking about why, at this point, we're dependent upon China so much and other countries for goods. And so, you know, why in the past our manufacturing sector has shrunk and our financial sector has increased. Now, What's one reason why this trend may even continue, though? One reason is government bailouts. I mean, these banks that were making huge returns, now that in a recent past they've made huge losses, what have we done? We simply bailed them out. We've simply taken money from the U.S. Treasury and given it to them. Yeah, exactly. See, every country that has done what we're doing has ended up in failure. See, we're doing exactly historically, we're repeating a pattern that has always led in catastrophe. Always. Because we're subsidizing weakness, we're making the whole system more political. See, which of those companies in America are receiving the most money? Well, those companies that have the most influence in Washington, D.C. It becomes a political thing. It also becomes a matter of size. I mean, what is the reason why we have given the banking system so much money? Because the banking system has become so central, there's been so many mergers, and instead of having a lot of banks, now we've got essentially five banks in America. I mean, there are many more, but a good portion of our banking system is controlled by only five banks. And so when they come on hard times, they go to Washington and they say, look, we're too big to fail. If we fail, the whole thing falls apart. So you have got to support us. You've got to give us money so we don't fail. And so those in government say, yeah, by gosh, you're right. You know, here's a couple of $1 trillion. But see, what we're doing here is we're subsidizing weakness. We're subsidizing bigness, which is not necessarily good for a free market system. We're injecting politics in this whole thing. You know, the market says those who survive and those who prosper are those who can compete best in the market. But what we're saying is, well, it's not those who can best compete, but those who can ensure the most political favors. See, this is what we call rent seeking. Rent seeking is, you know, you own a business and you've got $1 million, and you say, well, now, should I put this $1 million into my business and make a better product, or should I put this $1 million in Washington, D.C., and influence legislation that will benefit my company? And if you say, well, I can make a whole lot more return on my $1 million if I hire lobbyists and put the money in D.C., then I can make a better product, and that's what you'll do. That's called rent-seeking. When companies put their money into politics to influence legislation, that's what we call rent-seeking. And that has increased greatly over the past 10 to 20 years. You know, the financial sector has three lobbyists for every congressman. The financial sector, you know, banks collectively have put, you know, literally billions of dollars into influencing legislation to make it easier for them to do what they want to do. And if they fail, well, they just get bailed out. And you and I, as a taxpayer, pay the difference.
We pay them to conduct the business for us, and we pay them to fail at the business that they're conducting.
Exactly. Exactly. It doesn't seem right, especially if you're a taxpayer, right?
General Motors free money. I mean, if they give me a free car, yeah. Why should I give them?
Well, that's what we're.
Money and not give anything in return.
That's what we're doing there too. You see, we're saying, well, General Motors is too big to fail, so we're going to bail them out. Of course, there's always more than one reason, but. See, historically, you've always a method of gaining control over somebody is to put that somebody in debt to you. And that's what the government is doing. See, the more they bail out the banks, then the more in debt banks become, and same with the automobile business and same with the insurance business. And the whole point here is for government control. Well, if you, I mean, that's right, because I mean, if you really have a vision of what America historically has stood for in terms of, you know, free market, free enterprise type system, then you would be opposed to this, because this is definitely a move toward a centralized system where government controls things. And one of the dangers of government controlling things, see, in a market, decisions are made based on the market, right? I mean, in a free market, you're going to produce things that people want. And the more sensitive you can be to their wants, and the better able you are to provide for their wants, then the more money you'll make. But see, let's say the government takes over General Motors. Well, are they going to produce cars based on the market? Are they going to produce cars that people want?
No, probably not.
And what are they going to do? Like what? Like
safety,
hybrids, smaller cars, greener cars, right? I mean, see, they've got this. Now, what happens if we've still got competition here from other automobile companies, you know, like especially foreign companies. Now, what happens if General Motors starts manufacturing these cars not based on market forces but based on the political whim of the government, and people don't buy them? How are we going to encourage people to buy these cars? Well, if you're government, there are several ways you could do it. We could lower the price, or we could simply give tax rebates and say, okay, you buy this car and you'll give we'll give you a $5,000 tax incentive or something like that. But the point is that if we sell cars for less than their cost. So if you're looking at either a lower price, a lower than the cost, or a subsidy, it's ultimately the same thing. So how can a company like General Motors continue selling cars for a price less than their cost?
Assuming government.
Yeah, they could. How? I'm General Motors. You're the government. You control me. I'm selling cars for less than my cost. Now, what are you going to do? You're going to subsidize me. See, you're going to say, okay, for every car I sell, I'll give you $4,000. But where's that $4,000 come from? Taxpayers. See, that's the difference between the market and a political system, you know, determining what's produced. See, when the government controls, then things are produced in accordance to whatever view that the people in power in government have. And that can change, by the way. You know, you get one group that's in control, and they got these ideas, and so they enforce, you know, their vision upon in the production process. And then maybe in the next election, a different group gets in, they got different ideas, and so because they still have control, they impose. See what I mean? And so what you get here is you get unpredictability. See, the market is very predictable. But when you get government and things can change politically, then you get a lot of unpredictability. And with unpredictability, you get uncertainty. With uncertainty, you get hesitation. And a free enterprise system can't function with doubt and fear. I mean, you know, people make investments solely based on their expected return on their investment. You know, and what do they What do they think is going to happen in the future? Well, if you don't know what's going to happen in the future, then you're not going to take a risk of making that investment. And so what happens is that the whole pie shrinks. And that's what happens. That's always been what happens when government takes control of things. Well, we're not talking about the but in the market there are still things are more predictable because you know that things are going to work out at least according to market forces. And those market forces may not, I mean, no one can predict the future for sure, but on a scale of 1 to 10, if you know how markets work and you know the past history, you can pretty much, I mean, it's reasonable and maybe even logical to determine, you know, what's going to happen in the future. But politically, well, anything can happen. I mean, we can do a 180-degree turn in one day just with, a change in leadership. And that's totally unpredictable. So on a scale of 1 to 10, you see, I mean, it's more unpredictable.
And you're saying, as Google left to its own devices, would probably not screw up in the next 5 years and continue to be somewhat successful business. But if a variable like the government were tampering behind the scenes, there's no way of knowing 5 years from now what Google would end up.
Yeah, because, you know, politicians can make any rules they want. And those things change over time. And a lot of it changes according to the support they get financially. You know, you get special interest groups, and one special interest group puts a lot more money in, and they get legislation passed that favors them. And another group falls out of favor. I mean, it's just whatever is decision, the whim of those decision makers. See, in a market, it's the market that determines things. It's no one group, or you don't have any small, certainly you don't have a small group of decision makers determining things. The market is very diverse and very broad. But when you're talking about politics, then you're talking about a very narrow base.
And where they handle things like the automotive industry bailout, does that jeopardize the entire system?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. See, we're subsidizing weakness. Absolutely. And then if you let's say we let General Motors go bankrupt. I mean, Chrysler's declared bankruptcy. Does that mean that Chrysler it doesn't exist anymore? Well, no, those factories don't disappear. Those machines don't disappear. You still have, you know, workers. I mean, all that happens is maybe the company is sold off. I mean, maybe it could even be sold off piecemeal, and it may be sold off at very low prices. But I mean, you're still going to have these factories, and cars do wear out, and eventually we're all going to have to buy new cars, and those factories are going to be used to sell new cars. I mean, it's just not going to be the same entity any longer. It's not going to be Chrysler. It may not be General Motors. It may be, instead of one large company like General Motors, it may be five smaller companies. And it may not be, and they might not be controlled by the UAW as presently the case with the General Motors. I mean, it's just it'll be different. That's all. But our needs will still be met. But that's the way systems work. I mean, that's how a free market system works. And that's much, in the long run, that's a whole lot better for everybody than to subsidize the way that we're doing today.
So, I know it's off topic, but what's the logic behind doing it? Is it just the lobbyists? Is it just catering?
It's money and power and control. So when you look at politics, you got to get away from the market. You can't say, well, you know, what's best for us? What's best for the market? Things don't work that way. It's you know, what's best for those who are in power, and power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Power becomes an end in itself after a point, and control. See, people have these visions of how they want the world to look, and then they get into power, and they want to impose their vision upon the world. That's the story of mankind. Well, we really got off into it, didn't we?
Yeah.
But this is good stuff, right? But let's get back to these slides. We've got, let's see, we don't have much time here. And I do want to finish this chapter next time. Now, what is a payments deficit when more money is going out than coming in? Now, when can payments deficits be a problem? Of course, that can cause unemployment as less and less money is in the country. When is there a balance in the balance of payments? When the amount of money entering equals the amount of money leaving. And I think we're going to get some distraction here from over there. So let's pick this up next time in slide 25, because what I want to explain to you is why there's a balance in the balance of payments. Why, over the long run, the amount of money leaving a country equals the amount of money entering a country. That's an interesting topic. So,
you know, see, that really tracks even private movement of money as far as a whole.
Yeah, we have ways of. I'm sure we don't catch every dollar, but you know, we do keep track of the amount of money leaving and all. You know, because to.